You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Why keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro?
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 6, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the Uber blogger, Digby, on this whole notion that women are like people too. We'll be talking about all things conservative, all things attack on women. An interesting gambit. Apparently women, around 50% of the population. Also on the program today, Eric Holder explains, sort of, why our government can kill you, an American citizen, on foreign land. It comes down to more or less, trust us, you had it coming. It is, of course, Super Tuesday. 10 Republican primaries across the country. Which loser will win tonight? And does it matter? Also, the G8 summit. Looking for something a little more intimate than Chicago. Something just a little bit more, you know, we were thinking about that. And then we were thinking, yeah, why not all gather around a fireplace? G8 summit forced from Chicago. Oh, not forced. I mean, they just wanted something more intimate. And also, big story, LulzSec, a offshoot of Anonymous, a subset of Anonymous, rolled up, apparently had an informant in their midst. We will talk about that in the program today. And, of course, the right-wingers in South Carolina are insane. But first, before we talk about any of that stuff, the Romneys continue to give and give and give, regardless of what happens tonight on Super Tuesday. Conventional wisdom is that Mitt Romney will end up being the nominee. There has been a game plan provided, oddly enough, by Newt Gingrich on how to attack Mitt Romney. He is someone who is so out of touch, not just that he, because he has $250 million net worth to the extent that we can know because he hid so much of his money on offshore accounts. Not simply because he makes $20 million a year and pays less taxes, less on as a percentage on those taxes than I do on my significantly less than $20 million a year. Or your significantly less than $20 million a year. But because he is fundamentally out of touch, there's almost a disdain for people who are not rich like Mitt Romney. If you wear a poncho at a NASCAR event, you're wearing a cheap coat. Corporations are people too. I could go on and on and on. And despite the fact that his wife, Ann Romney, may not be as much of a jerk off about it as he is. The fact is that she is just as out of touch as he is. We've talked in the past about how she spoke about their roughing it when they were in grad school, living off of what in today's dollars would amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stock options and stocks that Mitt Romney's dad had given him. Remember, Mitt Romney's dad was not only a governor of Michigan, he was also the chair of the American Motors Company, a very large automotive company at the time. And here is Ann Romney trying to explain to all of you and us how she's just like all of us. Like, she's not blinded by her $250 million net worth, to the extent that we can know that that's all the money, because some of it may be on offshore accounts. She's not in any way deaf to the experiences of people who don't rake in $20 million a year and have, what is it, 4, 5 houses around the country. No. In fact, let's just hear her in her own words on Fox News.
And so, you know, we can be poor in spirit. And I don't look, and I don't even consider myself wealthy, which is an interesting thing. It can be here today and gone tomorrow.
Yeah. It's true. One minute you have $250 million. The next minute you could have just 20. But she is right. It is an interesting thing, because it speaks to the delusion and the bubble that she lives in. If you don't realize that you're wealthy with $250 million net worth, you cannot realize that there are people who are poor, or that there are people who are middle class that struggle. You can have absolutely zero concept of that. She's not just saying that she doesn't even think of herself as wealthy. She is saying what wealthy people experience every day, that they never even contemplate money, that it's simply not an issue, which is an experience that, empirically speaking, virtually no people experience. The idea that there is no thing I look at, there is no crisis that I could experience, there is nothing that could make me ask the question, can we afford this? Can my kids go to college? Can they afford braces? Can we put food on the table? Are we going to be able to pay for this if we have a healthcare crisis? None of it. And she's so oblivious that she can't even, like her husband, fake it. She doesn't even realize how offensive that is. In fact, she actually thinks that she's making herself like a common person by saying this. Only a person with a $250 million net worth could say something like that. I don't even think of myself as wealthy. I just think of myself as just really lucky to never, ever have to think about money for some reason that I can't possibly imagine what it is. It's interesting. All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the blogger Digby. Right back after this. All right. right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. And on the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the program the blogger Digby from the, I call it an Uber blog because it almost feeds directly into my brain. It's like an extra RSS feed. Of course, I'm talking about Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Welcome back, Digby.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
It's interesting, you know, how I know just how someone with so much money, like Ann Romney, can just not even realize that she's rich.
Well, this is the delusion of the American, you know, one percenters, or again, in their case, the 0.1 percenters. I mean, they're way up there. They believe they're middle class. I don't know where this comes from. I guess it's the idea that somehow they all think they're Warden June Cleaver and, you know, they're living in a suburb somewhere and their mansions, not even McMansions, are, you know, the way everybody lives. And that's just normal. I mean, you hear this all the time. This past week, we heard a bunch of whining from, you know, Wall Street investment types who are crying that they're not getting their bonuses because, you know, the lament was, unless you have money, you just don't know how hard this is.
It's true. It is definitely true. I think that, you know, as an experiment, maybe they should just lend us that money interest-free and maybe just gift it to us just for like 6 weeks so we could all suffer.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to run that experiment. You know, just let me have that money and I will report back.
I think Ann Romney must look at Mitt's jeans and just go, these are denim like everybody else's. They're not gold laced. Don't you? It's just amazing to me because I think, like, you know, it's exponentially that much more diluted because, you know, they don't even have the capacity to realize how offensive what they're saying is. Like, just sort of their number one goal, the only thing they wake up in the morning now and probably have done for the past 5 or 6 years, maybe longer, is just how can we project that we feel the pain of Americans? And they can't even do that. It's stunning. You know, maybe they're just that honest, I guess.
I think, you know, it speaks to his authenticity. You know, people give him a lot of grief for having no core, for being an empty suit. But, you know, this is him, and he can't help it no matter what, no matter how absurd it is. He can't stop himself from speaking the truth, which is that, you know, he's a rich and his wife, apparently. I didn't know this about her until this, but, you know, apparently it's both of them are just completely out of touch wealthy people who are living under some illusion that that's the way everybody else lives. And it, you know, it says everything about him as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't need to know anymore. The guy is deluded.
I've referenced this a couple times on the program, and I want to move on to this other topic. But before we do, I just remember, and it resonated for me so much because it really was a sort of I had an epiphany about politics back when Dukakis couldn't beat George Herbert Walker Bush. I mean, here's Mike Dukakis, a guy who literally shoveled the snow off his walk. It's not such a big deal, but, you know, here's a guy who understood what it was to just sort of live a fairly typical life in terms of his economic situation. And I just remember they brought out George Herbert Walker Bush's sister to explain how he was an average guy. And the quote was something to the effect of, like, we had such a normal upbringing. If we left our tennis rackets out in the rain, we got punished. And I just thought, like, they would walk off their court in their backyard and leave the tennis rackets there. And if they didn't bring them in, they would get punished just like everybody else. And this guy's got that same disease. I mean, I guess that's one of the beautiful things about being rich is that you never, ever get reminded that you're rich if you hang out with enough other rich people.
Well, compared to many of his friends, he probably isn't. I mean, compared to the donors to his super PAC, he's poor.
That's probably true.
I mean, he's not a billionaire. know, I mean, geez, he's suffering.
Yes, I only have, there's only like a 7 zeros after my net worth.
I know, I'm a failure. I mean, you know.
All right, but let's tack over because this has been, you know, I think, well, you write in this piece that you did about the 16 percenters, which is based on a piece in the Daily Beast, that for whatever reason, and we can imagine what those reasons are, but despite the fact that women have achieved not parity, but have achieved great gains in entering into the workforce, they still get paid less money for the same job. I think somewhere around 75 to 80% of what a comparable job would be. But women are incredibly underrepresented in leadership positions. And this is indicative of sort of a plateauing. And I think what we're experiencing in this country, a backlash against women's economic emancipation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been kind of wondering about this for a while because, you know, I grew up, with the women's movement and basically, you know, with the promise, I understood, you know, the argument always was that, well, it's going to take time for women to reach, a level of parity with men because they don't have the education experience, you know, everything in the workplace. They're going to have to get that. So my generation was going to grow into that, and probably the one coming up behind me would then, it would be there for them. Because obviously you go to college, you get the education, you work your whole life, you know, theoretically you should be able to gain the experience necessary in these various fields. And it's not happening. I mean, I'm old now, and it's not happening. And we're at 16%, and we're way behind other Western democracies in America. Our exceptionalism is showing itself in this particular way. And, you know, there's really no reason for it. I mean, women are educated. They are emancipated. They are, you know, free in most ways to pursue their dreams. Many of them are, and they're just not getting there. And there are many reasons for it. Some of it, you know, you can see articulated by such wonderful, highly paid leaders as Rush Limbaugh. And you can see it in other more subtle ways in which we continue to be unable to develop institutions and structures that allow for both family and work to be, reasonably dealt with through our, you know, various systems of workplace laws and government edicts. So, you know, we're stuck. And I continue to see signs that we're actually sliding back, which is very disturbing. I mean, it's one thing to stall out for a while. It's another to actually backslide. And what you're seeing with the reproductive right, assault on reproductive rights, is that backslide. And that's kind of at the center of the whole thing. Without that, women literally cannot be free to, to pursue their lives as full human beings. They just can't. They have to be able to control their reproduction. And we all thought that was pretty well settled. And it was great. You know, science had come along and solved this problem, allowed women to be women, but also allowed them to be fully involved in in every aspect of life outside the home. And now we're seeing, what I see is a really severe attack. Since 2010, there have been more than 1,000 laws put forth in the states and some in Congress as well to restrict women's reproductive rights. And we've seen these attacks on Planned Parenthood and, you know, everything that we've seen happen in the last few weeks with this new strategy that they have about, religious freedom or religious liberty, they're calling it. This is happening. It's not just a figment of, paranoid feminist imaginations. It's happening before our eyes. And I think it's something that maybe women are beginning to wake up to. I've seen it for a while. I mean, I think other people have been observing this kind of, some of this strange phenomenon. And now it's kind of coming to the fore. And thanks to Rush Limbaugh, and various other foolish people like, Komen for the Cure and others who were succumbing to this pressure, at the very least we seem to be waging the battle. You know, whether we win, I don't know, but at least it's joined,
Well, you know, I think the in some respects, I mean, the wonderful thing, to the extent that one can characterize it this way, about Limbaugh is that he basically ripped the veneer off of this attack on women. In other words, you know, I think that there's a tendency when you see things like personhood amendments, when you see things like in Virginia, a transvaginal, medical rape, essentially, in the event that women want to exercise a right that the Supreme Court has deemed to be constitutional. When you see these things, I think the first tendency is to sort of say, like, well, this is sort of like the white knuckled grip of religious fervor. But I think, you know, when Limbaugh comes out there and starts talking about this has nothing to do with, you know, starts characterizing women who take contraception as sluts. I think it really then exposes that this is, I think, even beyond sort of just sort of like an emotional misogyny. But I mean, you really do see that thing that Corey Robin talks about. This is a reaction to, I think, sort of the financial emancipation of women. I mean, does that make sense? I mean, I think like, there's a tendency that we say, like, oh, we're seeing these things strictly because of religious values. But I don't think that there is an increase in religious values in this country that are trying to subjugate women. I actually think on some level what we're seeing is that, particularly in a time of economic stress, that women are taking their share of the blame for entering the workforce.
Well, certainly. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, no, this isn't just a religious backlash. I mean, I don't think, you know, is Rush Limbaugh a religious guy? I mean, it sure doesn't strike me that way.
No, of course.
I mean, I don't think he is. And I don't think that whole, side, that whole faction, the sort of Rush Limbaugh, you know, misogynist faction, that doesn't come from religion. That comes from a sense of loss of control. And that's exactly what Corey Robin was talking about, was that this reaction to, you know, as he puts it, the family, the factory, and the field, which is these private realms of power that, you know, are the most important to conservatives, or reactionaries, as he calls them, that this is when threats to that become acute, is when they, you know, when they react. And I think that what's happened is, I mean, you have to look at this. I mean, in the great span of history, women's rights, women coming into the workforce, birth control is one of the most sociologically significant events in human history. It's big. It's huge. It's unbelievable. I mean, we sort of have been in this amazing world where all this stuff was kind of falling away and we took it for granted. But when you look at it from afar, you know, from 30,000 feet, as the political people say, you see that this is a major thing, and it's a great, huge challenge to the very basic, fundamental structure of our human organization. And I think that it's harder than we anticipated. I think it's not that easy. So what you're seeing is this backlash, which has been building for a long time, especially, as you point out, at a time when there's a real challenge going on economically. I mean, people are feeling a whole lot of, you know, when there's plenty to go around, people tend to be a little bit less intolerant, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, now that things are, you know, the jobs that men held for, you know, probably many of Rush Limbaugh's followers, you know, good well-paying blue-collar jobs, those are going away. And the jobs that are remaining are jobs that women are, you know, very much in competition for, much less these guys having to work for women or having their own wives, you know, working and feeling all that pressure. And, yeah, it's not that I'm unsympathetic to it, but it is exactly, you know, just because you're born as a white male, know, I'm sorry, that's not, that, you know, should not always be a ticket to, you know, your superior position in society. And yet I think a lot of these guys are quite shocked by the fact that that's not the case anymore. And I think, you know, I think that I look around the world and I see places like Iraq, for instance, where prior to the invasion, even under the monstrous, you know, totalitarian state of Saddam, women were, you know, operating as, you know, far more as equals in that society than they are today.
I mean, now, it's it is fascinating to note. I mean, in that that story in the Daily Beast, that our nation ranks 71st in the world in female legislative representation, yeah, behind Bangladesh, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates.
Yep.
I mean, that's pretty stunning.
I mean, that's shocking, I think. I mean, unbelievably shocking. And you know, I mean, here we are, you know, we're watching Rush Limbaugh, you know, go on a sexist tirade that to me is unsurprising because I follow him pretty closely. And he's beyond sexist. I mean, the man is really a deviant. And
right.
this is actually not that shocking. He usually is talking about feminazis and German shepherds and stuff. So this is right on par with what he normally says. It happened in the middle of a firestorm. And a constituency of women was already mobilized around a whole bunch of things that have just happened, you know, Plan B and the Komen for the Cure thing, Planned Parenthood, Rick Santorum's comments about birth control. All that happened, and then Rush came in with his disgusting comments, and people noticed and have mobilized against him. But, you know, this is, you know, this particular aspect of you know, anti-feminism or, you know, outright misogyny is actually nothing new. He's been out there doing this for a long time, keeping these people on par.
Right.
And as a result, you know, look, we've got 17 or six, we actually backslid. We had 17% representation until 2010. We now have less than we did. And when you see what happened during, you know, I mean, women in politics, the stuff that they get, you know, that is said about them is, you know, men take a lot of hits too. I mean, I'm not suggesting that politics isn't a tough game, but it's of a different magnitude.
Well, I mean, why do you think, though, this, I mean, you know, a part of it is that I think there were already women activist groups, other activist groups who were sensitized to these issues because this has been in the news. But I really think that the story about Limbaugh is that there's been this type of pushback. I mean, like you say, and I do think that, you know, there is a difference. And not necessarily in how sort of grotesque it is, but in terms of the target between feminazi and calling a woman who's choosing to engage or is talking about contraception as a slut. I mean, I think like it's easier, you know, like I'm just sort of like, you know, imagining, you know, my father's a fairly enlightened guy, but not that enlightened. And, you know, like, I think that, like, I can imagine people of my father's age responding like, yeah, feminazi. But mm-hmm. I think, like, the idea of, like, wait a second. I've always told my daughters not to, you know, to sort of make sure you're protected. And now she's a slut because of that? Wait a second. You know, there's no way. There's no what needle is she supposed to thread here? I mean, I think there's like sort of like he unleashed something, I think, that, you know, because people are saying this is much to do about nothing. But the very fact that you now have 14 or 15 or more advertisers dropping out of supporting Limbaugh, the fact that you have lost a couple of stations, I think sort of runs completely contrary to that notion. It obviously is resonating with people in a way that something hasn't resonated in the past. And, you know, the idea that this is just, you know, there is, to the extent that there is a democratic or a leftist media complex machine that exposes Limbaugh, they've done nothing different this time than they did any other time. It's just that this one hit. And so I think that speaks to something of a heightened awareness by women, by people who believe that women are people, you know, in our society that must exist.
Well, I think it's also, you know, I mean, yeah, I agree with you. There is, you know, this is a specific person for one thing. It's not an abstract sort of, you know, caricature that he normally does with this. So that helps. I mean, this woman, you know, she's an average, you know, American woman speaking about an average issue that all women. You know, I mean, 99% of women discuss, think about it. I mean, this is nothing beyond the pale. There's nothing about her that seems specifically threatening or in any way odd. So I can see that being part of it. And it's also that it's birth control. I mean, those of us who've been following this, if you follow the religious right, you know, a lot of their strategy has been leading toward this for a long time. I mean, they sort of fetishize the fetus as a way of kind of getting into this, but it was really always going back. It's beyond Roe versus Wade. It's to Griswold versus Connecticut. And, you know, Rick Santorum said this, you know, outright. He said this is, you know, sex is supposed to be procreative, right. The end, goodbye. And I think birth control has been bad for women. And he speaks for a lot of people of the religious right. I mean, they haven't been open about this, but, you know, if you follow them, you can see that this is truly what they believe, and it has to do with the idea that women should be in traditional roles, period. And I don't think people knew that, and I don't think that most people understood that this was where this, you know, accommodation with the religious right on abortion was heading. You know, these are, you give them an inch and they'll take a mile, people. And they do take a mile, and they always have. And here we are moving on a little bit to the next step, and started with the health care bill. And you could kind of see their forces sort of gathering there. So I think that this has been a big wake-up call for women in general who have been kind of, you know, going along and kind of saying, well, you know, people are funny, they're squishy about abortion, that's, you know, nobody's comfortable with it, it's an unpleasant subject, and it's not something that, you know, we believe in it, but I can see why other people have this, have right. a different view. Birth control, I think most people are going, whoa, you know, wait a minute, what is wrong with that? What's wrong with it? Tell me what's wrong with it. And once you start hearing it, you either hear Rush Limbaugh saying, oh, you know, all women who use birth control are sluts, or you hear the religious right saying, you shouldn't be outside the home. You should be at home procreating. That's your role.
You know, I think the interesting thing about Limbaugh is that he has shrunk that divide. Because, like you say, Rush yeah. Limbaugh has no religious bona fides. I mean, what he is attacking is the fact that women are empowered by birth control, by oral contraception in particular. They are specifically empowered by it. In the same way, you know, when we look at the disparity as to why there's less leadership roles for women in this country versus other Western nations, you know, I don't think the level of consciousness in this country is such that people perceive something like daycare as empowering women in the workplace. I just don't think that people conceive of it that way. I don't think that people conceive have been able to make that connection that oral contraception is also about empowering women in the workplace in terms of actually giving them full status in a country which up until never mind, didn't offer them the vote, but also used money and land holding as a means in which to disqualify people from participating in the political process. And I think, you know, when a guy like Limbaugh comes out and does this, he lays it, I hate to use the word naked in the same sentence as Limbaugh, but he lays it bare. And I think it's fascinating. And I wonder if that to a certain extent, we're seeing more of this backlash against women than we were, let's say, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, as a function of having of race being slightly encumbered as a political tool by mm-hmm. having a black president.
I think that's part of it. I really do. I mean, I think that I think that decent people have been successful at ensuring that you know, in policing our society about open racism to some extent. I mean, it still exists, and we all know that there's a whole, you know, underbelly of racism out there that still, you know, still functions as a big part, certainly on the right. But we have been pretty successful at keeping that kind of public, you know, open, you know, degrading sort of rhetoric at bay, at least to some extent. I have to say that, you know, I continue to be shocked by how casually people drop this kind of misogynistic talk and are then surprised when women are offended by it. I mean, this, you know, if you go back to the 2008 campaign, and I was talking about this on my blog the other day, and not just about Hillary Clinton. I mean, this was true of stuff people said about Elizabeth Edwards, people said about Sarah Palin. I mean, you know, there were plenty of women, Michelle Obama. I mean, look at the things that they're saying about her. I mean, it's just absolutely horrifying. And I mean, this is all, you know, these are specific gendered insults,
right,
that are completely acceptable in many circles, and not just, you know, by the way, in conservative circles.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've seen it in liberal circles too. And, you know, there's still a huge amount of leeway allowed to people to do this. Now, you know, as I said, I mean, this is a massive social change, and it crosses all cultural, you know, national, you know, this is a global thing. I mean, it's not just America. We seem to be less willing to confront this than our European brethren, for instance, many of whom, certainly in the Scandinavian countries, have addressed this in a much more systemic way. But, you know, nonetheless, it's happening to some degree all over the world, and it's a big deal. But I think we've ignored the fact that it's a big deal, and I think we've, you know, reached now sort of a critical mass where we have to start talking about this a little bit. This stuff is very, very toxic, and it continues. It's why we're stuck at 16%. It is the reason that, you know, when Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House, Rush Limbaugh went on the air and said that she was so great she could clip her toenails and breastfeed on the floor of the House at the same time. This was the most powerful woman in American politics, and that is how he dealt with it. And his audience loved it. They were talking about how, you know, all of her, you know, it was endless sexist discussions, and it's continued every minute of the day that she since then. Nancy Pelosi is a symbol to a large number of men of everything that they hate about women.
And, you know, I think that specific attack, like, you know, for instance, you know, I don't have as much problem with people saying one person is ugly or another person, because, you know, God knows I've made jokes about Mitch McConnell's looks, let's say. You know, there's a certain amount of that takes place. But the idea that Nancy Pelosi, like, there is nothing about Nancy Pelosi that should make you say breastfeed and toe clippings. I mean, that has nothing to do with Nancy Pelosi. I mean, I am a professional sort of like comedic, you know, insulter. And that has nothing to do with Nancy Pelosi.
I know. I mean, I could think of a million ways,
right,
to, you know, in a funny way to insult Nancy Pelosi, and certainly you can insult her politics. I mean, I'm not going to argue with Limbaugh's right to, you know, put down San Francisco liberals. I'm not going to be happy about it, but I don't see that as being any kind of a sexist insult. This kind of stuff that he did, and he did it on, you know, the day it was happening. He said something very, very explicit that day within that conversation about breastfeeding and all that. And this, I think, he, you know, sometimes he blurts it out, and people don't understand what he said, but he's blurted out the truth, which he says this is about the feminization of the culture.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he was upset. You know, clearly upset. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if people who are listening here, I mean, obviously, probably most of your audience does this, but, you know, Media Matters has cataloged all this stuff for the last, I don't know, since they started. And it's quite a collection if you ever want to go back and see. I don't think people realize just how pervasive it is and how constant. And it's not just him. It's the entire right-wing noise machine that does this, including, by the way, I shouldn't just attack men for this, because there are plenty of right-wing women who do the same thing.
Right.
You know, I call them the, you know, the sexist men and the women who love them. And, you know, there's a whole industry built up, and this is a huge part of it, even among the, you know, the Laura Ingrams and Ann Coulters and all these extremely strong women. I mean, these are not shrinking violets by any stretch. And they, you know, they adopt all this stuff too, without a, you know, even a second thought, from what I can tell. I think they're right in there. I mean, Ann Coulter has said that women shouldn't have the right to vote. So, yeah, there you go.
I mean, I think in her case, there's a decent argument, but you know, just the concept of, I mean, people should just stop and think for a moment about the concept of the feminization of the culture. I mean,
yeah.
Theoretically, right? Half the culture is
right.
Feminine. I mean, you know, like the idea of like the masculinization of our culture, one would never say that because that's the default. And, you know, I
guess. Right, it's called patriarchy.
Right. And that speaks to, I think, the idea that the fact of the matter is that when women become equal members of our society, and when they're given the full rights, there's going to be a loss.
Yep.
By men. And I think that's what we're seeing, is that this is being exploited. And,
yep.
You know, even to the extent that I think it does, to a certain extent, cross at least what we perceive on a surface level, some ideological levels. I mean, I always think of that moment when Chris Matthews, who, you know, I think he perceives himself as a liberal. You know, I don't know who it was. I think maybe it was Aaron Burnett, actually. Where he was just like, you know, she comes on.
Come closer.
You're hot. What? You're on TV, yep. Dude. What are you doing? Like, what are you doing? I just remember that moment of just like,
yeah.
He can't possibly think he's on. What? He's drunk. I mean, what's going on there? But I think to a certain extent, Rush Limbaugh has done this country a good service, at the very least, in ripping off the veneer that this is all about sort of, you know, respecting people's religious values. This is more about, you know, people just holding tight onto their place on the totem pole.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I mean, this is something that's really important. You know, you know, Sarah Posner she follows the religious right and writes for RH Reality Check and various other great websites that follow women's issues and the religious right, and it's fascinating stuff for anybody who's interested in this topic, as everyone should be. And she, you know, followed this thing called the Manhattan Declaration, which was a group of, you know, religious right and other conservatives who got together in 2009 and came up with this religious liberty strategy. This isn't just something that kind of came up out of the blue. It's not a spontaneous thing at all. It's a deliberate strategy, and it's specifically designed to create carve-outs for conscience, which will in turn, you know, in their view, create an opening to attack all of these, you know, Supreme Court rulings and various things that, you know, legalized women's rights and reproductive rights. And you know, there's even some theories that this is going to lead to a larger strategy of conscience clauses being applied to all kinds of things outside of that realm, in which case, you know, I don't feel like paying taxes for this, that, or the other, as a way of breaking down the federal government's ability to collect taxes to fund its business, generally speaking. Now, that's a very long-term strategy, but people should be aware that this is not something that, you know, that is just sort of came up out of, you know, a reaction, a spontaneous reaction. This is planned, and you see the Blunt Amendment that came through. Look how many Republicans voted for that.
Right.
That wasn't just a fringe. That was, you know, a party line vote, basically. I mean, they had what, three dissenters on that? So, you know, this is something that's going to be coming back. They're not, you know, these people are not ones to run in, you know, and turn tail and give up on a strategy the way the Democrats do at the first sign of trouble. They will continue to come back at this. I know that they believe that they have a winning strategy. They take the long view, and they will keep trying. So it's, you know, it's important to recognize this is really, really a big part of their long-term strategy. And, you know, maybe they're going to be defeated at the polls. Maybe, you know, people keep waiting for the, you know, illusory Republican establishment to step in and, you know, right the ship, make the party come back to reality. Maybe they can, but as far as I can tell, the Republican establishment at this point is the religious right and Rush Limbaugh and his people. And, you know, and a bunch of very wealthy guys who are willing to fund all that crap, people like, you know, the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and, you know, all these, they're so wealthy that they can afford to dabble in politics with millions and millions of dollars and basically change the course of history, you know, in it for their own, you know, discrete special interests, whatever those might be. In the case of those guys, it's ideological. Right. In others, maybe it's just purely, you know, a business deal. But regardless, I mean, this is going to be, you know, I don't see this going away. So I think that everybody should, you know, you take your victory and then go on and, you know, prepare yourself for the next fight, because it's not going to be over with Rush Limbaugh being taken off the air. Although, God willing, you know, please, if that happens, it will be a victory worth having. This guy is a blight on body politic, and he is long overdue to be taken down.
From your mouth, Digby, to the flying spaghetti monster's ears. from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Digby, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It was great as always.
All right, folks. We're heading into the better half of the program now. And for those of you who are not members of the Majority Report, you will not hear about this Lulzek anonymous story. You will not hear the rules that the South Carolina Republican Party have imposed upon themselves for future candidates. You will not hear whether or not you're eligible to be assassinated in a targeted killing by our government. Good luck. You will not hear what happened to that G8 summit planned in Chicago. My gosh. Do you feel deprived? Do you feel bereft? That can all change with one simple click of the mouse. Well, a couple of different clicks of the mouse, but maybe we should cut it down to one click of the mouse. But go to majority.fm, sign up to become a member. You will have full access to this. And how many shows we've done now? Like a couple hundred, at least. Shows in our archive, the full Monty, as it were, without the nudity. Become a member today, folks. Even if you don't want the rest of the program, even if you've been completely satiated by the first half, your becoming a member will ensure its existence. So please become a member today. Also, you can support this show if you buy junk through Amazon. Buy it through our link at majority.fm. Support the show. You'll see the Amazon link. Click it. Bookmark it. Buy your stuff through there. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, chocolate. Fair trade. If you haven't tried it, you're making a big mistake. You get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. And please, if you're a cheap son of a gun, take the moment to at least give us a review on iTunes. What's wrong with you? Buy some merch. We got merch. Call the show, 646-257-3920, or you can IM me at Majority FM. Super Tuesday. We'll be right back with the better half after this.